Welcome back for the second hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Audio open lines for the next half hour. The subject's going to be predominantly Islam. We're going to deal with a couple of subjects. A Muslim teen who is suing his high school, I believe, for holding the graduation ceremony at a church, or at least part of the graduation ceremony at a church. There are Shiite Muslims being attacked in Iraq during their holy pilgrimage. Nothing new there. Interesting, we don't often talk about Indonesian Muslims. Most Muslims live in the area around Indonesia. Does Sharia law hold sway there? I guess every day, in every way, a little bit more. And then we're going to be joined by Robert Spencer, who's authored the book, The Truth About Muhammad. We're going to be talking with him about the Prophet Muhammad and what we need to know about him and his beliefs and his followers. Dr. Duane Gish will be our guest from the Institute for Creation Research to respond to Newsweek magazine cover story, The Evolution Revolution, in the last half hour of Issues, etc. This happens every spring. It's time to hold a graduation. Someone gets their nose bent out of joint. This time it's a Muslim teen who's suing a school for holding part of a graduation ceremony at a Christian church. Here's the story from Fox News.
A Muslim teenager suing public schools in Newark, New Jersey, because his high school held its graduation in a church. Now, he claims that he couldn't attend because he believes that his religion forbids him to enter any buildings with symbols involving God. Well, we received this statement from the school district. It says, as New Jersey's largest school district with some of its oldest operational educational facilities, we occasionally must find affordable, convenient, and safe venues to hold large-scale events. The occasional use of available space belonging to a religious entity is permitted under federal and state laws. Even if space needs require a ceremony to be held in a church, it should be noted that there are no religious components to the ceremony. Joining us now is Deborah Jacobs, Executive Director for the ACLU of New Jersey. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Well, you know, the first thing I thought when I heard about this story was, don't they have something better to do? You know, look, it's one kid and this huge high school. The rest of them don't have a problem. You know, deal with it. But then you start thinking about it, and you go, well, why did a school have to hold an event in a church? What was the key issue?
Well, for the ACLU, we were contacted first in 2005 by another Muslim family with the same complaint and concern, and we discussed it with the school district. We understood they had short timelines and had already made the reservation, and we agreed not to sue, and with the understanding it wouldn't happen again. Next year, it happened the same thing. Another family contacted us. So I agree with you. The Newark public schools have a lot of important issues that need addressing other than this. But what are we supposed to do when a 4.0 senior can't go to his graduation because the school made this choice? Secular locations were used before 2005. They've got one lined up for 2007. This shouldn't have happened.
So it was 2 years in a row. And I understand that the school said, yes, we're having it at this church, but we'll do everything we can to conceal any sort of religious symbols. And I think that there's a discrepancy about whether or not that actually happened, whether they did.
Well, you know, people of every faith, you find a broad range of practices and beliefs within each religion. Mm-hmm. And in this case, the young man assessed the situation and decided he really felt it was violating his religious beliefs to go in. The building itself is a symbol, really.
Now, he clearly believes that. The executive director of the Islamic Society of North America says that he's not aware of any Muslim saying it's against the Muslim faith to go into a building that has symbols of God in it. How does he explain that?
Of course, there's a broad range of practice within every religion. Even you think about from a Reformed Jew to an Orthodox or Hasidic Jew, and you might get different opinions of religious practice in there. And in this case, we had two families who told us, you know, this is against our religion and we really can't do it. And you know, even if we didn't have a family complaining, the idea of the First Amendment of the Constitution is that the government should take a position of neutrality towards religion. That idea is what allows us to be a prolific religious nation. And so,
isn't it? I mean, it's that the government won't force you to practice a specific religion.
What neutrality means is that it'll neither endorse nor discriminate against religions or religious practice. So it should never hold
an event. But they weren't saying, come on in and, you know, convert. They're just saying, hey, we're going to hold your high school graduation here.
Well, as if that wasn't bad enough, there's actually one other element, is that students who attended the baccalaureate were offered two extra tickets to graduation. The baccalaureate is a separate religious ceremony that took place in a Catholic church. So in a way, they were encouraging religious practice by saying, if you come to this, you don't get to just have your parents, you get to have your siblings there as well.
Okay, so the first year you didn't sue, they do it again a second year, you're suing. What is he asking for? What is the ACLU suing for?
Well, really, we want to make sure it doesn't happen again. We had an honor student who was excluded from one of the really important ceremonies in our lifetimes, and he lost out on that because of the school's insensitivity. So that's number one. We want to make sure that doesn't happen again, and that there will probably be some compensatory damages for the young man because he did miss out on this really important thing.
Mm-hmm. But he's not asking for a specific dollar amount right now?
I don't believe so.
Okay. Thank you very much for telling us about this. Deborah Jacobs, the executive director, ACLU of New Jersey. Thank you.
I got a real simple solution for this one. I cannot believe no one else has thought of this. There are plenty of Christian churches out there with no symbols whatsoever. In fact, no crosses. You can walk in. I've been into them. You can walk in and you do not know whether you are in a church or a theater. It's obviously something where people gather because there are lots of chairs all pointed in the same direction and usually a stage. But no symbols that would betray the fact that this is a Christian church. In fact, I've been to one of the largest in the United States. Jeff and I took a trip up to Chicago, last year sometime it was. I remember it was hot. So it must have been in the summer. And we went to visit Willow Creek Community Church, one of the more influential megachurches. Did the sign outside have a symbol on it? No, it just said Willow Creek Community Church Campus or something like that. Drove in. You can search the entire place over. You will find some pretty decent coffee at their little cafe. The one symbol they don't issue there is the dollar sign. There's still dollar signs on the coffee on the menu there, but there are no crosses. None. There's your solution. If public schools want to hold their graduation ceremonies in churches, just go to the churches that no longer are willing to display any Christian symbols. It's very, very simple.
And isn't it amazing how American evangelicals decry the secularization of the culture, and they don't see it in their own churches?
No.
We have no Christian symbols here.
No, really. They're proud of the fact that there are no Christian symbols in their churches, and they're ashamed of the fact that the Ten Commandments aren't posted on the public square. Could it be any more backwards than it already is? Never could be. Oh, by the way, Sunday night on Issues, etc., we are going to discuss this subject in one way. We're going to talk about church architecture, which of course includes the symbols that churches display. Pastor James Wettstein of Valparaiso University will be our guest. There's my solution. Here's a question, a serious question. Is it wise for schools to hold graduation ceremonies in churches? You will run into this with most Christian churches, that there will be symbols of the Christian religion, crosses and the like. Unless, of course, you go for the Wilkin option, which is just find yourself one of those Christian churches that no longer displays the cross or any other Christian symbols. And voila, the ACLU will never bother you again. Would you want your church to host a public school graduation ceremony? Next on Audio Open Lines, a CBS News report about how Shiite Muslims in Iraq are finding it very dangerous simply carrying out their holy pilgrimage.
What began as a holy pilgrimage ended as a mass funeral for more than 100 Shiite families. And amid the burials, more bloodshed. At least 11 Shiites were killed in a fresh wave of attacks as they made their way towards Karbala for a religious holiday this weekend. Now pilgrims are greeted by extra security forces lining the road into the city south of Baghdad. Officials in Karbala say they've deployed some 10,000 police officers trying to keep Shiites safe as they prepare to mark one of their holiest weekends. And the Pentagon is reporting more American casualties. Three U.S. soldiers were killed by a roadside bomb northwest of Baghdad while on a mission to clear explosives from a well-traveled route. The nonstop attacks in the war-torn country will be at the center of a weekend summit in Baghdad. The White House was quick to confirm the U.S. will be attending, and now leaders from Iran say they'll be there too. It will be the first encounter between U.S. and Iranian envoys since 2004. And it comes as the White House takes a harder line on Iran, insisting that the country is backing militants in Iraq.
Iran needs to make sure that there is no more exporting into Iraq of people who are committing acts of terror and also weapons that are being used to kill Americans and Iraqis and others.
Iranian leaders say they have some concerns about attending the global meeting, but they insist it sends a clear message that neighboring countries are standing beside Iraq during its struggle for security. Aline Sergani, CBS News, Washington.
Okay, now see, this is just shows how complicated the situation is and how necessary it is for us to understand that countries like Iran and Iraq are Muslim countries. They're not countries that just so happen to be populated by Muslims, and that really is irrelevant to how the country is run. We are finding out very quickly that a misunderstanding or a failure to understand Islam as a religion in general can be very dangerous. So we have our soldiers over there trying to clear pilgrimage routes for Muslims of the explosives that may be planted there, that are certainly planted there. Our soldiers are dying in the process of doing this. One of the basic things we've failed to understand about Islam is that, and we'll talk about this in about 15 minutes on the program with Robert Spencer, there is no separation of mosque and state in Islam. Phone lines are wide open for your questions and your comments. Our call-in numbers live this Wednesday, the 14th of March, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. I'm Todd Wilkin. You're listening to Issues Etc. When we think Islam, we generally think the Middle East. But strictly speaking, that's not right. When you think Islam, if you want to think in terms of population centers, you should think of Indonesia. When you think Islam, you should also think Sharia law. We tend to think, well, Sharia law is what the Arab Muslims are practicing over there in the Middle East. Well, what about Indonesia? Here's a story from Reuters.
Well, Indonesia's Aceh region is now one of a handful of places in the world operating under Sharia, or Islamic religious law. Women must be covered from head to foot, and things like gambling can be punishable with a public caning. And now there's some concern that conservative religious movement could have implications for the war on terror. Freelance reporter Maria Scavicampo is in Jakarta and joins us now on the phone. You with us, Mara?
I'm here. Hi, yes.
Tell us a little bit about what you're learning out there and about this new threat from Sharia.
Right. Well, most people know the Aceh region of Indonesia from the tsunami. It was one of the hardest hit regions and was really devastated by the tsunami. And now they're really strictly enforcing Sharia, Islamic religious law. The law itself is not new, but after the tsunami, some people interpreted that as an act of punishment from God for sins that they were committing. And so they started to really focus more on enforcing the Sharia more strictly. And now they're looking to expand it, to expand the laws to cover non-Muslims and to increase punishments. Right now you can be caned. That's mm-hmm. one of the punishments. And they're looking at a proposal to cut off hands for stealing. And so the concern now is that the region is becoming potentially a haven for extremist Muslims because of the conservative direction that it's headed in.
And is it in any way threatening to Indonesia's help in the fight on terror?
No, not necessarily. But what is concerning is that there are other parts of the country that are looking to the region as a model. There are people in the country who would like to see all of Indonesia be under Sharia law. Now, there's no indication that's going to happen anytime soon, but they do have their eye on the region to kind of model for what the country could be.
Is there any concrete evidence that the Islamic extremists are moving into Aceh in rapid force?
Not right now, no concrete evidence, no, but there are some people living in the region who are convinced that it's only a matter of time. The reality is that officials are considering expanding the laws, they're considering punishments, so the region is definitely moving in a more conservative direction, and that has a lot of people worried that could attract Islamic fundamentalists.
Okay, well, Mara Scavicampo, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us.
I don't know. I remember it had to be the late 80s, early 90s. There was a young guy traveling and I think it was in Indonesia, and he ran afoul of the law, probably public drunkenness or something like that. And remember the big caning incident that they had with this kid where he was going to be caned as part of his public punishment for his crime, an American citizen, and there was all sorts of diplomatic going backs and forths, and then eventually the kid was caned. Did you ever hear anything about this being part of Islam? No. So, perhaps our failure to understand Islam as a social, legal, political, and religious force is older than September 11th. Did you hear that part of the story where the Muslims there, the consensus of the Muslims in Indonesia was, here came the tsunamis, they devastated our country. They said, this must be a judgment from Allah. And their response has been, we need to crack down on the Sharia law. We haven't been practicing Sharia law fervently enough, so we need to crack down on Sharia law. It's amazing that people are now concerned about quote-unquote radical Islam entering into Indonesia in force because people are practicing Sharia law. Now, that operates on a huge assumption. The assumption is that there's a difference between Islam and radical Islam. I'm very curious about what Robert Spencer is going to make of that distinction that's so often made when he joins us here in about 10 minutes. First, let's talk with Sherry, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Sherry calls from her car. Hi, Sherry.
Hi there. My comment is about the ACLU story. I thought that Muslims, they call God Allah, and I thought that they believed that we believe in the same God, right? I mean, am I wrong here, or only because that's why I'm confused why they won't enter the building if it's just a building that represents God.
Oh, I see what you're saying. So let me make sure I know what you're saying before I let you go, Sherry. That Sherry was under the impression that Muslims believe that Christians and Muslims worship the same God. That's not true. Now, there may be Muslims in the United States or elsewhere who hold that opinion that Christians and Muslims are worshiping the same God. In fact, there are Christians who hold that opinion wrongly, but they hold it nonetheless, that Christians and Muslims are worshiping the same God. How they hold that opinion beats me. They basically argue that Allah is the Father of Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, when Scripture clearly says you cannot have the Father without the Son. In fact, I think Jesus says that. You cannot have the Father without the Son. So without the Son, and Muslims are certainly without the Son, the Jesus they believe in is just kind of Allah Jr. Without the Son, they cannot have the Father. But there are Western Muslims and Western Christians who believe that, Christians and Muslims worship the same God. But I've been assured by Dr. Ergun Kaner, who's a Turk and a former Muslim himself, I think he was a Sunni, that when he was a practicing Muslim, the thought never would have even crossed his mind. He would have considered that blasphemy of the highest order to even suggest that the Allah he worshipped was the God that the Christian worshipped. He's given us the distinct impression as a former Muslim, now a Christian, that Muslims are taught that Christians worship a false God. At least this young Muslim he might be a little over-enthusiastic, but this young Muslim who has sued through the ACLU because of this graduation ceremony in a Christian church, at least he's adhering to what Islam actually teaches. Sad to say, his Christian counterparts might not have a problem at all. They might be able to have a graduation ceremony in a mosque under the false impression fed to them by some Christian teachers that it's all one big God. It's all the same guy. Allah, Jesus, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. What difference does it make? At least he's being consistent. Staying on the subject of Islam for the last few minutes of this audio open lines, here's a story from CNN on textbooks in Spain in response to some Islamic concerns. By the way, the Muslim population in Spain is big and growing.
In the land of churches, Roman Catholicism's influence so deep that religion class is routinely offered at public schools. Now, some see hope and a solution here for the clash of religions in Europe. Within earshot of the church bells, a new textbook, Discovering Islam, for Muslim students. But not in Arabic, it's written in Spanish, the local language.
Everyone can have their own religion, but if they feel Spanish, they'll behave like Spaniards and be a constructive, not destructive, element in the society.
The rapidly growing number of Muslims in Spain also want a religion class during school. This lesson on the Quran. The new textbook describes it in Spanish, the Libro Sagrado, or the Holy Book of Islam. A lot of eyes in Spain and across Europe are on schools like this one to see if the next generation of Muslim children will assimilate here. Most Muslims in Spain are first generation, new immigrants. But this leading imam in Madrid worried about integrating the children. He co-authored the new book.
The book could even promote interreligious dialogue right in the earliest years of childhood, so it would be completely normal.
A government-backed foundation gladly funded the new book.
If you study in Arabic, you think in concepts from other places. And here, you need to think in European concepts. So you have to speak Spanish to think in Spanish.
Some conservative Catholics criticize public funding of the Islam book, but proponents counter the church gets far more state aid than other religions. In Zaragoza, the school is 70% immigrants from 15 nations. A reflection of the rapidly changing old central neighborhood here, a scene repeated in large cities across Spain. The task, experts say, getting students like Sabrina to have a stake in Spain. Sabrina's mother, Wasila, fled Algeria a decade ago during the Civil War. Sabrina and her little sister, both born in Spain. Their mother likes the new Islam textbook. She says it helps keep traditions in the new homeland. Al Goodman, CNN, Zaragoza, Spain.
Well, the big issue here, of course, and it's throughout Western Europe, as more and more Muslims emigrate, the big issue is assimilation and integration. In some countries, like France, there's some difficulty of native Muslims, non-native Muslims, integrating and assimilating into the culture and society. Britain is having similar problems. Spain says an easy way to solve this is to have Islamic textbooks in their public schools that encourage interreligious dialogue. Of course, Spain has a long history of dealing with the Muslim population. There was once a day when Spain was a Muslim country, and the Christians were in the minority. And we should not be so naive as to believe that here in the United States, where the Muslim population is still just a couple percentage points of the total, that we won't have to face the same issues. So we should probably understand what Islam is and isn't. We'll do that here for the next hour of Issues, Etc. after this break. Robert Spencer has written a book called The Truth About Muhammad, founder of the world's most intolerant religion. He's director of Jihad Watch, and we'll talk with him for an hour after this break. Then we'll spend a half hour talking about evolution and the Newsweek magazine cover story with Dr. Duane Gish.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
If you'd like to sit in on one of our Bible study broadcasts, here's good news. We're taking the Bible study on the road. On Wednesday, March 21st, we'll originate our regular Bible study program from St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Columbia, Illinois. Pastor Stephen Tice will be both our host and our guest. Why don't you come to our live broadcast and bring a friend? Lunch will be served afterwards. I hope to see you Wednesday, March 21st, 10:05 in the morning, for our live Bible study program from St. Paul Lutheran Church in Columbia, Illinois.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Kim Troby, sitting in for Bob Dittmer. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Peter Pace, is taking heat from gay rights groups for saying, quote, homosexual acts between two individuals are immoral, unquote, and have no place in the military. The comments were made Monday during an interview with the Chicago Tribune. Steve Jordahl has reaction.
Federal law prohibits gays from serving in the military, but under President Clinton's policy called Don't Ask, Don't Tell, gays can serve if their sexual orientation is not revealed. General Peter Pace, responding to a question Monday, said according to his upbringing, homosexuality is immoral and has no place in the armed services.
I would not want that to be our policy, just like I would not want it to be our policy that if we were to find out that so-and-so was sleeping with someone else's wife, that we would just look the other way, which we do not. We prosecute that kind of immoral behavior.
Gay advocates like Steve Rawls with the Service Members Legal Defense Network are reeling and want an apology from the general.
It's not appropriate for our nation's highest military commander to denigrate the men and women in uniform who are sacrificing so much. It's fine to make a policy judgment. It's another thing entirely to make a moral judgment.
Elaine Donnelly with the Center for Military Readiness says a sorry is unnecessary.
Well, that's absurd. There is no need to apologize for a law that was passed overwhelmingly with bipartisan majorities in Congress and that has been upheld by the federal courts several times.
In a statement yesterday, General Pace said he stands by his comments. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
Pace also said he wished he would have focused more on public policy and, quote, less on my personal moral view, unquote. Current estimates say there are 65,000 gays serving under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. For Family News in Focus, I'm Kim Troby.
If all you seem to be doing on the job is waiting for a change, waiting to be downsized, waiting for someone else to move on so you can move up, then it's time to consider doing something positive for your career. Education is still the best way to accomplish your goals for a better future. The Educational Opportunity Centers are where you'll find free services to help you determine what kind of higher education or courses could enhance your career or help you begin a new one. Call today at 1-800-875-5932.
Issues Etc. is underwritten in part by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of our Book of the Month for March, Easter Is For Me. For more information, look for the Easter Is For Me cover on our homepage, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. Easter Is For Me by Dandy Daly Mackle. It's a helpful resource to help teach young children about the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Easter Is For Me. Here's a happy AM850 KFUO salute to our day sponsors on this Wednesday, March 14th, 2007, Michael and Crystal Niehoff. Today's day sponsors have made a contribution to AM850 KFUO in celebration of their 20th wedding anniversary. Once again, a very special thank you to Michael and Crystal Niehoff of St. Charles, today's AM850 KFUO day sponsors, and our very best wishes for a happy anniversary.
The face of terror is not the true faith of Islam. That's not what Islam is all about. Islam is peace.
President George W. Bush addressing the issue of terrorism and its relationship to Islam, he said Islam is peace. Many people believe that Islam is peace. The question is the president right? We're going to answer that question here right off the bat for this hour of Issues Etc. Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. If we believe that Islam is a religion of peace and that Muhammad was a prophet of peace, a bringer of peace to the world, then how will we view those who follow Muhammad today and their aims, or those who call for jihad in the name of Muhammad? And what are the consequences of thinking that Muhammad is a prophet of peace? We'll answer those questions. Our call-in numbers for the next hour, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, or email us here in the studio at issuesetc@kfuo.org. Robert Spencer is our guest. He studied Islamic theology, law, and history for over 20 years. He's director of Jihad Watch and author of several books, including his latest called The Truth About Muhammad, Founder of the World's Most Intolerant Religion. Robert, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks, Todd. Thanks for having me back.
Is President Bush right when he says Islam is peace?
No, unfortunately not. There are many peaceful Muslims. That's not in dispute. But the fact is that the Islamic faith is the only major world religious faith that actually has a developed doctrine and theology and legal system that mandates warfare against unbelievers. This is a matter of public record. Anybody who wants to verify that statement can check the Islamic texts for himself. I invite everyone to do so who's listening. In my books, I give the citations very carefully for everything that I say. This is because, of course, obviously, when you have the President of the United States saying the opposite, when you have many other people saying the opposite, I wanted to make it very clear where I was getting these things and why.
So what are the consequences? I know this is a huge question, but what are the consequences in a nutshell if someone believes that Islam is a religion of peace and Muhammad was a prophet of peace?
Well, there are many, many consequences. For one thing, if you believe that Islam is a religion of peace and Muhammad was a prophet of peace, then you are not going to be likely to pay attention to the ways in which the strategy of the jihadists is, the agenda of the jihadists, I should say, is being advanced in nonviolent ways. Because, after all, Islam is a religion of peace. So why, for example, would you look into the American mosques and monitor the American mosques to see if they are preaching anything but peace? The assumption, which is a completely unproven assumption, that the jihadists are a tiny minority of extremists condemned by the vast majority of Muslims, is a variation of that idea that Islam is a religion of peace. And the problem with it is that, if you have, as Freedom House, the Center for Religious Freedom, demonstrated recently in a study last year, they went into mosques all over America and they examined the textbooks, the things that were out to teach the people, that kind of thing, and they found not peace, but they found doctrines being taught to high school students and to adults of Islamic supremacism, of the idea that Muslims must ultimately replace the U.S. Constitution with Islamic law. And this kind of thing just continues to fly under the radar screen of the mainstream media and government, all too many government and law enforcement officials, because they assume that Islam is a religion of peace, and so what's going on in the mosques is ipso facto harmless and need not be examined.
I've often wondered about this. You mentioned before the many peaceful Muslims. There are many American Muslim groups that are doing their best to try and distance themselves, or sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, from what's being called radical Islam. Are they being honest, in your opinion? Are they fairly representing what Islam and Muhammad the Prophet were really all about?
Well, it depends on which groups you mean, of course. When you're talking about the mainstream Islamic groups, you have, for example, the Council on American Islamic Relations, which bills itself as the leading American Muslim civil rights organization, and loudly maintains that it is moderate, that it has condemned terrorism, and so on. And yet you have, even with the Council on American Islamic Relations, some very serious questions that the organization has never addressed. For example, they've had several of their officials arrested on various terrorism-related charges, convicted of those charges. They've never explained how it is that these people could have been hired if their view of Islam was so different from that of this supposedly moderate group. They've never explained why it is that some of them seem to have a disturbing record of making statements that are plain and simple, of Islamic supremacism. Ibrahim Hooper, the spokesman for the Council on American Islamic Relations, has said that he would like to see the United States become Islamic sometime in the future, but that he doesn't want to do this through violence, but through education. Nonetheless, this is the same goal that Osama bin Laden has, and it should be recognized as such. And the Council on American Islamic Relations should be regarded as a group that is working for the same goal through different means that Osama bin Laden is working for. Now, all this comes from a readiness to acknowledge that there is more to Islam than this assumption about peace, that there's more to Islam than the unproven idea, the unestablished idea, that really they are completely committed to peaceful coexistence with non-believers as equals. That is not part of the doctrines of Islam. And when you have American Muslim, moderate Muslim leaders saying that they'd like to see the United States become an Islamic state, we have to understand that means, because of the nature of Islamic law, the institutionalized subjugation and discrimination against non-Muslims. And that's obviously at variance with American values, but because Islam is a religion of peace, this is the kind of thing that never gets examined.
So they're not talking about proselytizing in the sense that, say, Christians would say, well, I'd love to see France re-Christianized or something like that. They're talking about a wholesale change of the culture, the politics, the law, under a Muslim worldview.
Quite right, Todd. Exactly. They're talking about replacing the U.S. Constitution, essentially, because there are, we have to be honest about this, and this here again, this is something that is readily establishable by reference to the Islamic texts. There are many elements of traditional Islamic law that are completely in contradiction to the U.S. Constitution. And so to say that you want to see the United States government become Islamic is saying that you want to see institutionalized discrimination against women and religious minorities.
Now, along with all of this has come a makeover of Muhammad himself.
Yes.
What is the picture being, what's the popular picture of Muhammad today that many believe? And if you would contrast that with the real picture of Muhammad.
Well, you know, Todd, I think most people know actually very little about Muhammad, and they assume that because he is the founder of a great world religion, that he must have taught peace and the fatherhood of God and the brotherhood of man, love your neighbor, like all religious figures do, like Jesus did, like the Buddha in some way did. You know, I'm talking about a generalized understanding that Americans have without really knowing. They assume, I think, that the Islamic faith and Muhammad are essentially the same as all other religions, and it just teaches love and peace. Unfortunately, however, Muhammad did not teach love and peace, at least for non-Muslims. You can say, certainly, that Islam is a religion of peace for Muslims. In other words, a Muslim is not supposed to, although this is often transgressed, not supposed to fight another Muslim. You can say that Islam is a religion of tolerance and of benevolence and of compassion for Muslims, but not for non-Muslims. Muhammad taught, in fact, that it was part of the responsibility of the Muslim community to wage war against unbelievers under various circumstances, that they should meet the unbelievers and invite them to accept Islam. If they accepted, then not to fight them. But if they refused, then to invite them to enter the Islamic social order as second-class citizens, with this institutionalized discrimination that I've been talking about. And if they refused that too, then to go to war with them. Three choices: conversion, subjugation, or war. This is what Muhammad taught. And he didn't just teach it. He was also a warrior. Now, the fact that he was a warrior, you know, Todd, I want to emphasize at this point, I'm not making this stuff up, and I am not going digging into old dusty books and finding things that no Muslim knows about today to try to paint a black picture. The fact is that Muslims know very well that this is what Muhammad was like. Mukhlas Imran was the mastermind of the Bali bombing when some jihad terrorists in the resort area of Bali set off a bomb in a nightclub and killed quite a few people a few years back. And Mukhlas Imran has issued a statement saying, look, Muhammad himself killed the unbelievers. He himself fought in 77 battles, and we're just imitating him. Zarqawi in Iraq, before he was killed, people asked him, you know, why did you behead Nicholas Berg and film the beheading and all that? And he explained, look, after the Battle of Badr, which was the first great victory of the Muslims in Islamic history, Muhammad the Prophet beheaded his enemies, and in this he gave us a good example. And so if these kinds of things make it clear that not only did Muhammad do these things, but that in doing them he provided what is seen by Muslim, by the jihadists today, as an example for behavior. And this is why peaceful Muslims, moderate Muslims, people of goodwill who are not interested in fighting this jihad warfare and actually oppose it, this is why they need to stand up and confront these elements of Islam, these elements of Muhammad's teaching, and say, well, look, it's true that he did those things and said those things, and so we're not going to consider him an example in those particulars at this time or any time in the future.
Why is Muhammad such a, I'm trying to figure out the best word for this. Why is it that when Muhammad is described in the way that you're describing him, maligned in any way, mocked in any way, why is the reaction from Islam so very strong?
Well, you know, Todd, in Islamic theology and in the Quran also, it's the Quran itself, Muhammad is called the excellent example of behavior. And this has been extrapolated in Islamic theology to the idea that Muhammad is essentially perfect. Now, he's depicted as sinning a couple times in the Quran itself, but this has registered very little in Islamic tradition. And the idea that prevails, basically, that if Muhammad did it, it's right. That if he did it, then that is basically what a Muslim should do. And so with Muhammad as the supreme example for human behavior, then you have all kinds of Muslims around the world, many, many Muslims around the world, looking to all the aspects of his life and considering them models for emulation. Now, when you talk about insulting Muhammad, this is something that happened during his lifetime also. There were some poets who made fun of him at the time of during his prophetic career. And one of the things that is an unfortunately recurring feature of his prophetic career, especially in the later years, is that he would actually ask his followers for volunteers as to who would kill these people, who would assassinate these poets who were making fun of him, because, well, he didn't take kindly to being kidded. So he did find volunteers. They killed the poets, and he rewarded the killers. And so in this, he not only gave an example of assassination of one's opponents, but he also gave an example for the proposition that somebody who insults Muhammad only deserves death, is to be killed.
We're talking with Robert Spencer, author of the book The Truth About Muhammad, director of Jihad Watch. He studied Islamic theology, law, and history for over 20 years. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address, issues@kfuo.org. Robert, at this point then, it sounds as though, to go back to where we began, those who say the true followers of Muhammad are not the so-called radical Muslims are failing to understand who Muhammad really was. And in fact, those who truly appeal to the true Muhammad are the members of radical Islam.
Unfortunately, this is the situation. There's no central authority within Islam. You know, there's nobody that can say this is true Islam and this isn't. And I'm not actually saying it either. All I'm saying is that there are elements of Muhammad's teaching that the jihadists are pointing to and saying we're just doing what he did, and you guys, that is the peaceful Muslims, ought to be doing it also. And so, on the basis of presenting themselves as the exponents of true Islam, of pure Islam, they are getting recruits from among peaceful Muslims, and they are indeed, as you say, successfully able to portray themselves as being the true Muslims, as opposed to moderates who they are able to say are not the true Muslims because, precisely, they are not being violent, they are not waging war against unbelievers.
So that explains what you say in your book, that it's not as important, it's not so important who Muhammad really was, as it is important what Muslims think Muhammad really was.
Precisely, yeah. You know, Todd, that's a very, very interesting, at least to me, line of inquiry, that is, what Muhammad really was, or who Muhammad really was, what he really said and did. But it is, and there are some very great historians and researchers who are doing some very fascinating work in that field. But that is not what I'm doing in The Truth About Muhammad, because in the first place, it is largely, although I have immense respect for the work that these scholars are doing, it is largely speculative because the information is so sketchy. The first biography of Muhammad that appears in the Islamic world comes out 150 years after his death. And so, ultimately, we can know very little or nothing about Muhammad and what he was really like. But what we can know and what we need to know is what Muslims think he was like. That is, what the canonical texts of Islam, the Quran, the Hadith, the early biographies, what they say about what Muhammad was like. Because if they regard him, as they do, as the supreme example of human behavior, then it's very important for us to know what exactly that means, what kind of a man they're going to be imitating, whether he was really like that or not. And there's quite a bit of evidence to suggest that he wasn't really like that, even if, or may not even have existed at all as the person that is portrayed in the Muslim sources. But the Muslim sources are very clear about the teachings of Muhammad, extraordinarily detailed about his sayings and doings, and those texts are influencing Muslims to this day. And so I think in these days of terrorism, and not only of terrorism, but of the terrorists invoking Muhammad's name to justify what they're doing, well, it becomes a very important matter for non-Muslims to know what Muhammad was like according to those texts.
All right, then let's talk about who Muhammad is portrayed as being in his life, his prophetic career, his military exploits, according to the texts of Islam. I guess the first basic question is, if one picks up and reads the Quran, will they find out much about Muhammad there?
No. The Quran is kind of like this. Imagine that you were talking with a friend of yours about things that you were involved in with him, and I walk up, and I don't know either of you, and I start to listen, and you don't stop to explain what you're talking about to me. That's like reading the Quran, because the Quran is a monologue, really. It is Allah, the supreme God, talking to Muhammad. And as he talks to Muhammad, they are talking about various aspects, various events in Muhammad's life, but not bothering to explain them, because obviously Muhammad knows what happens in his life. And they're talking about various moral precepts and religious precepts, and those are relatively clear. But quite a few incidents are only alluded to in the broadest way and not filled in. So you have to go to Islamic tradition, to the Hadith, to find out what these texts are really all about. And this becomes a matter of what is known as the Asbab an-Nazul in Islamic tradition, the circumstances of revelation. Quite a few of the Islamic traditions, the Hadith, fill in the circumstances in which Muhammad is supposed to have received these various particular messages from God that make up the Quran. In other words, this was happening, that was happening, something else was happening, and then Allah revealed to Muhammad this, which is in the Quran. And so you can read all those things, and you begin to be able to piece together a relatively coherent narrative of Muhammad's life.
With a few minutes here before our break, who was Muhammad before he becomes the prophet?
He was a merchant. He was a merchant in Arabia. He was from the city of Mecca, which is, of course, now the holiest city in Islam. And he was somebody who was, according to the early Muslim sources, identified as a prophet by Jews and Christians in the area. When he was a young boy, they saw, apparently, supposedly, on his body various signs that their prophetic books predicted that the coming prophet would have. And they identified that he would be a prophet. But, of course, these are fanciful stories, legendary stories, as evidenced by the fact that Muhammad, by all accounts, didn't grow up being hailed as a future prophet, but grew up as as an orphan and as a merchant who had to make his way in life and who ultimately impressed a woman 15 years his senior, who was a businesswoman in Mecca, by handling her affairs in trade so capably that she offered to marry him. And he did marry her. She became his first wife, Khadija, and the first believer in Islam after he began to receive these prophetic messages.
And how did that work? Was it simply out of the blue that Muhammad begins to hear from, or so he believed, Allah?
Muhammad was depicted in the earliest Islamic texts as being a man of prayer, a man of great piety, even before he received any revelations. And so the implication is that Allah's hand was on him from the beginning. In the Islamic texts, it says that he was, on a particular night when he was 40 years old, praying on a mountaintop when the angel Gabriel appeared to him. But he did not identify it as the angel Gabriel immediately. The early Islamic texts, as a matter of fact, say that he didn't know who it was. And he was terrified because this angelic being, this spiritual being, was pressing him very hard so that he thought that he was going to die and demanding that he recite. And he said, I can't recite because I don't know how to read. And the angel just pressed him even harder and demanded again that he recite. And finally, he went home in a state of tremendous agitation and said to Khadija that he was afraid that he was possessed by a demon because of this spiritual visitation that he had received. And here again, this is straight from the Islamic texts. And she took him to her uncle, Waraka bin Nawfal, who was a Christian priest. And according to the early sources, it was Waraka who identified him as a prophet and said, you don't have to worry, that wasn't a demon, that was Gabriel the angel, and you are the new prophet of Allah.
We're talking about Muhammad. Robert Spencer is our guest. He studied Islamic theology, law, and history for over 20 years. He's director of Jihad Watch. He's authored several books, including his latest called The Truth About Muhammad, Founder of the World's Most Intolerant Religion. The website address for Jihad Watch, by the way, is jihadwatch.com. It's all one word, jihadwatch.com. Now we'll respond to your phone calls and your email after this break and continue our conversation with Robert Spencer. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, and our in-studio email address is issuesetc@kfuo.org. Let's see, we're going to give away the book to our best callers or emailers, 1-800-730-2727, or issuesetc@kfuo.org. The book is called The Truth About Muhammad. Real quickly, with 1 minute before we go to this break, when the revelations come and he is eventually convinced that he's hearing from Allah, how does he write them down? How do these things eventually get into the Quran itself?
Well, he doesn't write them down. According to the early sources, he was illiterate himself. But he would recite them, and his followers memorized them. And the various of his followers had memorized various portions of his revelations. After his death, according to the canonical stories, in any case, the Caliph Uthman, his third successor as the leader of the Muslim community, gathered together all the people who had memorized various portions of the Quran and had it written down. And there were some variants but that were written that he had destroyed.
So what we have by way of the Quran itself is the recollections of Muhammad's earliest followers, at least according to the Islamic text.
Yes.
The recollections of Muhammad's earliest followers of what he said Allah told him.
Exactly.
Did they regard it immediately as divine revelation?
Oh, yes, because that's what he represented it as. And as a matter of fact, it was his only evidence for being a prophet. He was challenged frequently to produce a miracle, and he told them, the only miracle I have for you is the Quran, and how could this sublime poetry, as it is represented as being, and it is quite beautiful in Arabic recitation, how could it have come from a mere mortal? And he would challenge people, and the challenge is twice in the Quran, if you think that this is just a human book, then produce a surah or a chapter like it. And actually, there are people, you can go to surahlikeit.com and find people who've taken up the challenge. But it's kind of a self-defeating thing because, of course, there's nothing that anybody could write, no matter how sublimely beautiful or how much like the Quran, that any pious Muslim would actually accept as being like the Quran.
Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. We're coming to you live this Wednesday, the 14th of March, and we're talking with Robert Spencer about the real Muhammad. When we come back, after his prophetic career, what about Muhammad as warlord, as a man of military exploits, flying in the face, of course, of the popular view that Muhammad was a prophet of peace? Stay tuned.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.